Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Kaelin McPherson.
And I'm Justin Romero. Today, on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with Paul Smart, who talks to Danny Hill about the updates to Lincoln Park made by the City of Albany. Then, RPI student Soraya Mboa speaks with Steve Pierce in the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Later on, Willie Terry reports on the May Day teach and that he attended. After that, Treasure Irvin interviews Tashina Medina about her activist journey and her work with Equality for Troy. Finally, Sina Basilihicky talks to Belinda Colon, the current exhibition at the Arts Center of the Capital Region. But first, here are the headlines.
The town of Bethlehem is proposing to allow affordable housing developments to be considered. Despite the current townwide construction moratorium, the building moratorium was set in place last year as the town works through a new comprehensive plan. Affordable housing has been discussed as a priority since rents in town are considered to be a burden on low-income families.
Courts recently dismissed a Republican-led court effort to invalidate the endorsement slate of the Albany and Schenectady County's Working Families Party. Similar efforts have been filed in many upstate counties, including Rensselaer, over the use of electronic signatures on authorization forms, which have been approved via executive order by the governor.
Times Union reports that the state's COVID-19 test positivity rate Saturday was below 1.5% for the first time since late October, a continuation of a decline trend that signals a return to pre-COVID normalcy could be on the horizon.
The Gazette reports that 36% the low-income neighborhoods of Hamilton Hill and Valley and Schenectady are significantly lagging behind the rest of the county with respect to the percentage of the residents who have received the COVID vaccination. Republican rural communities are only doing slightly better than the inner city neighborhoods.
For the first time in decades, members of Congress have the power to earmark billions in federal funding for specific local projects. The process has been halted due to corruption scandals. The Times Union reported that Congressman Tonko included $6 million to buy 8 electric buses in Montgomery County, $4.5 million for transportation centers in Amsterdam, and $1,000 for bridges in Saratoga County. Delgado asked for $1.1 million to expand broadband in Ghent, Cannes, New Lebanon, and Austerlitz, and $1.1 million to expand a rail trail in Sullivan County. He also asked for money to create a new child care center. For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOA Low Power 106.9 FM Albany, and WCAA Low Power 107.3 FM Albany, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
Our mission is to use art and participatory action to promote social and environmental justice and freedom of creative expression. This program is produced by community members and funded in part by monthly donations from Sanctuary sustainers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call us at 518-272-2390. I repeat, 518-272-2390.
The City of Albany has been touting its planning upgrades for Lincoln Park for a while now, but with work starting badly with the cutting of a couple dozen treasured old sugar maples, the community trust and confidence in the city plans broke at the get-go. HMM's Paul Smart speaks to the community member Danielle Hilly of A Block at a Time.
Residents of Albany's South End have been furious of late as the city took out over two dozen mature sugar maples from Lincoln Park, along with the area's basketball courts. There's been much talk of a major investment in upgrades to the park, but the latest action has shaken the community's confidence and trust yet again. Danielle Hilly of A Block at a Time explains.
I got a text message that said they were cutting trees down in Lincoln Square. So I basically hurried up and I got over there because, you know, it was only like 10:30 in the morning. So I'm thinking, okay, what the heck is going on? I thought that there was supposed to be a plan to ensure that we saved as many trees as possible. And, you know, what are we doing? So many of us just found out about the actual plan for the basketball courts was like about a month ago. Mm-hmm. Most, like, the community really didn't have the opportunity to look at it. So the best way to characterize this is during the meeting that they had the end of 2018 into the beginning of 2019 and through January of 2019, there was support for having basketball courts. So they put basketball courts into the plan, but only gave us an approximate rendering of what we were getting. And they said to us, you know, this looks sort of like what it's going to look like, but, you know, it's not exact. So the community was kind of under the impression that there would be opportunity to have that discussion and, well, first of all, to see what they were proposing and then to have that discussion. So on the 16th, the Manchester Neighborhood Association saw the plans because I asked about them while we had Jonathan Jones on the meeting. On the 30th, the Lincoln Park Alliance provided the rendering to the community, and then on the 8th, they cut all the trees down. So within 9 days of most people getting the plans, they had cut the trees down. People in those discussions were under the impression that as many trees as could be would be saved. Now, in hindsight, listening to that statement, it wasn't a lie, but it was very misleading because they knew back in December that none of the trees could stay with the design that they had picked.
Uh-huh.
So in saying we will keep all the trees that we can, they already knew that they couldn't keep any of them. So the contractors weren't really forthcoming, and when I spoke to the city, I called David Gallen. He said, what do you mean they're cutting trees down? They weren't supposed to cut trees down. They were supposed to only be putting up fencing, which actually turned out to not be correct. Mm-hmm. Evidently, they were told to cut all the trees down. They were withholding information from the community while simultaneously deciding what was best for the community. Basically, what they're trying to hold their hat with is the community said they wanted basketball courts, and the community said they wanted us to do the basketball courts first. Okay, the community may have said they wanted basketball courts, but nobody said we wanted this. Like, wanting something and you deciding what it is. Like, you deciding how to interpret that want are very different things. Like, the way that I've been explaining to people who both say they gave you what you want and, oh, people will never be happy. Imagine if you said to me, hey, Danielle, I really like a pool. And then I showed up at your house and I dug a massive hole in your front yard to give you this pool. And you're like, what are you doing? And I'm like, but you said you wanted a pool.
Yeah,
and I thought it would go best here in the middle of your front yard. Like, that's basically what the engineer and subsequently the city, because the contractor is following the plans from the engineer and the city, that's what they did. They said, oh, you guys want basketball courts? This is what you should get.
Is there a sense of apology on the city's part that could make up for this in another way?
So Originally, it sounded like that at the meeting that we were at this afternoon that got cut short by the protest. Originally, it sounded like the mayor was really taking, like, owning it and understanding that the community was not involved as they should have been. But then when it was asked by one of the board members from the Lincoln Park Alliance, to put the project on hold pending community input, the mayor's tone drastically changed on us.
Uh-huh.
Like, she went from, we understand, we're never going to screw this up again, like, we really, we're sorry, to, well, if that's what you want, and you want to, you know, we'll throw this $1 million project away. That's basically what we got after we said we want, after it was said that, said, and multiple people agreed, that this should go on pause. To put this trust issue into perspective, like, they are saying that this project is justified by the overwhelming support by the community. Now, there is one thing that came out of those meetings that's 100%, it's not 100%, it's 1,000%, it's 1,000 to the 10th power% undisputable. The community wants the pool to remain the way the pool is. There is absolutely no questions about that. The community wants that pool replaced with an identical pool, or at least as comparable to that pool as absolutely possible, which is basically to just give us that pool again. So right. Even knowing that, even with something that had absolute 100% support, Weston and Sampson, the company that's designing this stuff, has still tried multiple times to change the pool's design. In fact, the last one that they put out turned it into two pools, two rectangular pools. So it's very hard for me to hear them say that, oh, the community wanted this, there was overwhelming support, knowing that they have disregarded multiple times something that has tremendously more support than these basketball courts.
Are there next steps that people are looking at this point?
So right now, the mayor says that she's going to have a meeting with her heads of her department, and they're going to talk about, you know, pausing the project and if there's a path to moving forward. Then the Lincoln Park Alliance is going to start putting together some community meetings and trying to work pretty quickly to get some community input and to try to get answers to the questions. I have, like, a whole list of questions I was hoping to get answers to until the mayor abruptly ran off because of the protest.
This has been Paul Smart reporting for Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Correspondent Paul Smart talking with Daniil Hill of Block of the Time about the planning of upgrades to Lincoln Park and now they're getting postponed.
Steve Pierce of the Sanctuary for Independent Media was interviewed by RPI student Soraya M. Bawa. The Sanctuary for Independent Media is an organization that supports social, cultural, and environmental justice through media and creative expression.
Hello to all our listeners. My name is Soraya Mbawa, and today I'm interviewing Steve Pierce from Media Sanctuary. Steve, would you like to introduce yourself a bit?
Yes, my name is Steve Pierce, P-I-E-R-C-E. I'm the executive director of Media Alliance, which runs the Sanctuary for Independent Media and a bunch of other projects under the name Media Sanctuary.
And so, Steve, what would Media Sanctuary's mission statement be, and how has that mission statement impacted the community?
Well, we have a very long and convoluted mission statement that we reduced working with our board a couple of years ago to something pretty straightforward. We use art and participatory action to promote social and environmental justice and freedom of creative expression. And that's what we try to refer to whenever we have projects put in front of us and when we're trying to decide how to move forward. We try to keep a social justice, arts, and creativity mission foremost in whatever we do.
So how would the strive to social justice in media relate to some of the goals of your organization, and what would be some of the biggest challenges while achieving those goals?
Well, that's a great question. It works out on a few different layers because, first of all, there's media justice itself, just the notion that people have an inherent right to have access to media and to know about the techniques of media production and have access to the tools of production. What you see today is really an unraveling of our media system in this country where, I mean, we're all swimming in tons and tons of media, but we have very little control over what the products are that dictate the shape and the direction of our culture. And that's a terrifying thought because our experience of the things that are happening around us are our experiences are mediated. We don't have direct experience with what's going on in the country and in the world. We hear about it through media. It's important who's running the media and what their goals are. And it can't just be profit making. So that's one level on which we're very engaged in media. But also, we have a hands-on attitude about media and the role that it plays in society. So we think it's really important that we create the media that's required for people to have a better understanding of the communities with whom we work, and also that we teach folks in those communities to use media and be able to express themselves through media. So there's a lot of different levels that media plays a major role in our work.
Right. Steve, some would say that a huge part of media justice incorporates proper representation of different cultures. How would you say your organization uplifts these different cultures?
Well, I mean, so that happens on a couple levels as well. One thing is to make sure that when you're doing story assignments, that you're choosing the stories that matter most to the people who you're trying to represent. And so that means that if police community relations are a big deal, we should be covering that. If COVID is a big deal, we should be covering that. But we also should be covering aspects of the story from the perspective of the people who we're covering. So there are many, many stories about COVID. There's many, many stories about police community relations, but very few of them are from the perspective of the people who are most affected by those stories. So that's one thing. The other thing is to train the people who are most affected so that they can represent themselves. We don't have to represent them. We can provide training and tools so that they can represent themselves. And that's a challenge because you're talking about people who don't normally have access to these things. And it's a hard work to get them in touch with it.
So speaking of COVID, during this whole pandemic, how would you say Media Sanctuary has adapted its programs to the pandemic? And how has it aided the community in that way?
Well, there's some ways we've adapted and there's some ways we haven't. I mean, the most obvious way we haven't adapted is our music presenting, which was a very strong part of what we were doing, bringing in acts from all over the world, a lot of them from Africa. And we haven't been able to do any of that at all since March 2020 because the touring circuit has stopped. Nobody's doing it. It's not safe to travel. It's not safe to congregate in indoor spaces. So we're not doing it. We've done other things instead. We've had online music components of all the online presentations we've done, and we're working on developing our archive of recorded music so that we can get out material that we have in our vaults that nobody's ever heard. That's both one impact that the pandemic has had on us and one response to it. We've also done a lot more things online, and I think we've pivoted very successfully. I'm proud of the work that our volunteers and staff have been able to do in that regard. For example, we heard about the New York State shutdown on a Friday in March. And on that week, all of our things had been done in person studio interviews. Our meetings were in person. Our production gathering on Monday night was in person, everything. And over the weekend, we shifted to an entirely online presence. And so our editorial meeting on Monday was online. We started training our producers to use Zoom, and a lot of them had no idea how to use Zoom. And we also taught them how to record and edit remotely. And we didn't skip a beat. The news program came on that Monday, produced entirely remotely. So that was great. And we've also done a number of things that we haven't been able to do before, wouldn't have been able to do before. We had a filmmaker who's appeared at the sanctuary in person, Chilean filmmaker Patricio Guzman, did an interview or workshop about his new film, but he did it live from his kitchen in Paris, which we never would have done before. We've had a number of productions that have included people from all over the world, and we've as presenters, and people all over the world as participants. So you know, that's a huge thing. We've pivoted our production online and our distribution online. We've done lots more environmental justice work, partly because we were starting to do that anyway because of our new Nature Lab project, but also partly because it became easier to organize online than it was to organize in person in some way. And we've also continued doing our gardening and a number of other activities, like our youth program, Uptown Summer, which was carried on, scaled back, but carried on, and also our after-school workshops. So we've been able to do a lot of stuff in spite of the pandemic and in some ways because of the pandemic.
So for your online presence, does it also include social media?
Yeah, we have a lot of social media presence. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and a number of other social media platforms as Media Sanctuary. And we also are on YouTube and SoundCloud, and also our own website, which is mediasanctuary.org.
So as vaccines are being distributed, we might see a different shift to like better circumstances when it comes to social distancing this year. What kind of opportunities or what's next for Media Sanctuary?
Well, you know, everybody's asking that, right? The situation is pretty much out of our control. We don't know what's going to happen next with the pandemic. I don't know that these virus mutations were entirely expected. At least I didn't expect them. And we don't know the path that that's going to take. Distribution of the vaccine seems problematic. In some ways, it seems like it came as a surprise to our government that we would need to distribute the vaccine after it was produced. So those things are out of our control, and all we can do is have, you know, best-case scenarios and worst-case scenarios. At this point, we're assuming that there won't be much in-person gathering really of note through the spring, and probably summer. We're not planning for it. We're expecting that there might be some socially distanced outdoor opportunities in the summertime when it's warm enough for people to congregate outside. And then we're thinking there might be continued outdoor socially distanced activities in the early fall when it's warm enough. And maybe we could have some indoor activities that are greatly reduced in terms of the attendance because we have some large presenting spaces. You know, a lot of it's a wait and see thing. We're not going to give up on our online capacity. In fact, we're continuing to develop it, but we're also doing work indoors. We have a new boiler getting in tomorrow at the Sanctuary for Independent Media, along with ultraviolet filtering and outdoor air improvements for our furnace. So we're doing the steps that are going to be needed to move indoors, but we're not planning to do it.
Thank you, Steve. And lastly, last question, is there anything else that I haven't asked you that you would like the listeners to know?
Well, just to say that we are very grateful for everybody's patience and support. Some of the things that folks have been used to for the past 15 years of our operation, we haven't been able to do because of the pandemic. And some of the things we've changed, and people are really doing their part, migrating to our online platforms, Zoom and YouTube and the other places where we have a continued presence and expanded presence. And also, we should thank everybody who's been supporting us, because as the potential for generating revenue from in-person events has declined, has dropped, vanished, evaporated, people have really stepped up with their online donations and other forms of support. And that's what's making it possible for us to forge onward.
Well, thank you, Steve. Thank you for all that information. And thank you to our listeners for listening in to Steve Pierce from Media Sanctuary. And I guess that concludes our interview. Thank you.
Hudson Mohawk Magazine is an initiative for the Sanctuary of Independent Media, and you just heard from our co-founder and Media Alliance Executive Director, Steve Pierce, being interviewed by RPI students Soraya Mbala.
For those just tuning in, I'm Kaelin McPherson.
And I'm Justin, and you're listening to the Hudson and Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson and Mohawk Radio Network.
To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org. If you have comments, suggestions, or warm regards, just email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or find us on social media at Media Sanctuary.
On April 30th, 2021, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine Network roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry attended the May Day Zoom teach-in. Willie recorded the presentation given by Jeribu Hill, the executive director of the Mississippi Workers Center for Human Rights. The topic was Which Way Forward for the Working Class. Heather Benro, a member of the Party for Socialist Liberation, was the moderator. In this labor segment, you will hear part one of Ms. Hill's presentation.
For this evening, I am very excited and also honored to introduce Jeribu Hill. Ms. Hill is a civil and human rights attorney and community organizer. She is the founder and executive director of the Mississippi Workers Center for Human Rights. Jeribu is an author and an international spokesperson on civil and human rights topics, a former safety and health specialist with NYCOSH. Ms. Hill advocates for safe workplaces and humane treatment of workers in Mississippi. Through her organization, Attorney Hill has provided legal representation and advocacy for hundreds of workers in the state. Hill and the center have successfully joined with Mississippi workers to improve workplace conditions and force employers to adopt and enforce policies against racial harassment and all forms of discrimination. Joining workers in their fight against workplace human rights abuses is at the very core of this work. To date, the center has successfully represented victims of workplace sexual and race harassment and retaliation and joined with workers to provide trainings and listening sessions as well. Jeribu is a former Skadden Fellow and a 2020 recipient of the American Public Health Association's OHS Section Tony Mazzocchi Award. Please join me in welcoming Jeribu Hill.
Thank you so much. Good evening, brothers and sisters, comrades. Thank you, Heather, for the introduction. As we're coming to the end of Worker Memorial Week and Worker Memorial Day, which was celebrated on April 28th of this week, we remember those who died while trying to make a living. I ask you for a brief moment just to pause and reflect on and remember those who gave their lives while trying to make a living. Thank you, and in their names, may we continue the fight so that no one has to die to make a living. I want to thank my brother Willie Terry for making it possible for me to join you on screen this evening. Willie and I go back a long way. We've been comrades for many years, and I honor and appreciate his work in the movement for the freedom and safety and dignity of the working class. I also want to thank everyone who is going to be presenting and all of the comments that are going to be made even before they're made. The participation and the conversation that we're going to have is so critical, so important, especially in these times. And so I bring you greetings from the Mississippi Workers Center for Human Rights, where since 1996, we have been laboring in the vineyard, fighting alongside workers for their dignity and safety on the job. This coming December 30th will mark our 25th anniversary of doing work in the state of Mississippi, most of those years in the Mississippi Delta, where 43 to 50% of the population resides in abject poverty. where a state where less than 5% of all workers belong to unions or any organizations that would protect their rights on the job. Which way forward for the working class movement? This is a question for any 21st century worker organizing project. May Day, a time to rededicate ourselves to centering the will and wants of the sufferers, the working poor, the unorganized. The holiday established to advance a socialist movement led by the working class. Surely, the struggles that Heather has already highlighted brought about significant righteous reforms, such as the 8-hour day and higher wages, and an end to some of the most abusive and horrific workplace conditions. All of these reforms were necessary and needed and provided some relief for the working poor. Many courageous battles were fought against greedy bosses, goon squads, union busters, and police. These battles provided the fervor needed to build the movement. But today, the U.S. labor movement is in a perpetually stagnant position, with less than 20% of all workers organized into unions. There is no independent labor movement led by the working class. Top-down white male-led unions, often steeped in the right-wing politics, still represent the dominant pools of leadership in the traditional labor movement. These dismal statistics continue to provide a sobering reality for the U.S. labor movement. After decades of widespread exploitation and denial of labor and human rights, the working class is left to fend for itself. Grinding low wages, cyclical poverty, retaliation, inhumane living and learning and working conditions illustrate the urgent need for labor to rise to the occasion and launch robust campaigns aimed at building worker power. Worker power means those who urgently need to get relief from the indignities of low-wage, dangerous jobs get the support they need to build from where they are. It is not a feasible plan to wait until every worker is organized into a union, though we believe that must be the ultimate goal. It is not a feasible plan to continue to promote stale and unworkable models of leadership. Clearly, these models do not reflect the 21st century face of the working class. Clearly, these models are steeped in white supremacy and capitalism, and they are beyond obsolete. These models are not new. They have been there since the beginning of organized labor and before. As long as U.S. labor remains tied to the system of capitalism and white supremacy, it will never be a worker-centered formation. As long as it remains tied to the political parties of the rich, it will never meet the needs of the sufferers. It is way past time for there to be a resurgence of more than a conversation, but a movement to establish a labor party in the richest country in the world, the most highly industrialized country in the world. Yet you can see small developing countries with parliaments that have a labor party. And here in the United States, we have no such expression that would articulate the just demands of the working class. A party that will not bow down to the will of those who have always betrayed us. If we face the truth and get past our own subjective disappointments, we will acknowledge there has never been a time when workers and their families have been able to live a quality life under the Democrats or the Republicans, or under the system from which they are spawned, capitalism. Instead of building worker power and striking blows at the systems that crush that power, organized labor has consistently urged its members to put their faith, trust, hopes, and dreams in the Democratic Party, often employing the lesser of two evil standard. Labor leaders appeal to their members to vote Democrat. They deliver the votes of the sufferers into the hands of the same forces who time and time again have put profit before their needs. What was eliminated from the stimulus package as a compromise, as a way to make the package more attractive to Republicans and conservative Democrats? The $15 wage, the living wage of $15 proposal was pulled from the stimulus package. The timing was wrong. It will be introduced at a later date. When? We should not accept these life-crushing compromises. We must demand accountability. We must offer alternatives to our people. We must be the ones to We must not be the ones to sell anti-worker concessions. We must join with workers to build anti-capitalist models. We must not cooperate with an anti-worker system to give comfort and ease to corporate bosses and lying politicians.
A special thanks to HMM correspondent Willie Terry for keeping us updated on the first part of Jeribo Hill's presentation on Which Way Forward for the Working Class.
Troy Pet Media Club member Treasure Irvin interviews Tashina Medina about her activist journey and her work with Equality for Troy, including their recent vaccine pop-ups.
In your perspective, how is the present day different from when you were growing up, and how has equality changed over time?
So in my day, the only thing that has changed is that the abuse is now publicized, meaning everyone has a phone in their hand. So the only thing now is that it's getting national recognition, meaning back in the day when they were hosing us down or catching us and lynching us in the nights when they're on their nigger runs, they can't do that now because everybody got a phone that's attached to social media. So that's the only difference. As far as equality, we only have equality when we have capitalism. And when you have capitalism, you have white supremacy. So there's nothing has changed. Because as long as we have capitalism, we will always have white supremacy in America.
What made you become an activist? How did it change your life?
I was 7 years old. I grew up in, as I said, East New York, Brooklyn, Cypress Projects. And my best friend, Bebe, got killed while we were playing Double Dutch. And I will never forget Al Sharpton came to my neighborhood as he was running local politician to say that he was going to get some justice and change the type of, you know, conditions that we were living in. And I grew up, you know, in the 80s during the crack era, you know, and stuff like that. So he made a whole bunch of promises that he did not fulfill. And to this day, my best friend, her murder is still unsolved. I remember being 7 years old, crying my eyes out, sitting out with a sign. My grandmother, Ethel Sandlers, she was one of the biggest activists in East New York. And she always taught me to never let nobody silence me. If it's wrong, it's wrong. It don't matter the color behind it. It don't matter politics behind it. If it's wrong, it's wrong. How did it change my life? I'm not gonna lie, for a long time, I was very smart in school, always aimed. And then after that, when you go through certain traumatic experiences, it does change your life. And for me, it changed my life for the worse But I think it was God's plan to train me for what I'm doing right now. It's, you get there, it's wisdom with age. So how did it change my life? I went from being a part of a problem to being the solution, or part of the solution to the problem.
Could you tell me a bit about what you are working on with Equality for Troy?
So I am the founder and I am the executive director of Equality for Troy. I founded this last year, 2020. Right now we have harm reduction services, which mean that we give out, Equality for Troy is a non-judgment organization. So we don't care if you're homeless, we don't care if you're a drug addict, we don't care if you're alcoholic, we don't care whatever you're coming to the table as, we are going to accept you because everybody needs a positive space. So that is what we are about. So we have harm reduction programs, we have free meal programs, and now we have the food security program. And now we just enacted, we have a free health clinic that will be located downtown. We have 4 doctors on staff to deal with the homeless community. Something that the local government in Troy never even thought of. We are the first overdose and prevention program in Troy, New York. We do definitely need volunteers because we're on the floor every Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday, giving out fresh needles.
What is your opinion on equality? How do you see it?
We can't have equality until we have accountability. We can't have equality until we can acknowledge the harm that has been done in the American culture. If we can't even get local municipalities to understand that they need to deal with the BIPOC community with a little more fragility when they're pulling them over, not thinking every Black person is guilty. We need to get certain stigmas out of our mind and American culture that has been embedded into us and our history and our constitution. So I think until we start there, we can't. But everybody say, well, what about the reparations? We can't have reparations until we have rehabilitation.
What are some challenges you had becoming an activist?
What challenges have I seen? The Troy local government, Mayor Patrick Matting, and he's very harmful. He's a businessman. He's not a mayor. I wish he would stop that. He's a businessman. So we don't need businessmen, we need community builders that is focused on servicing all people of the community, not just one section of the community.
Why are you doing vaccine pop-ups? Will you be planning more in the future?
One thing about me, I listen to the community. I always got my ear to the streets. I'm from the ghetto. I'm from the hood. I always protect the people that are at risk the most, meaning homeless, elderly, children. So when I put my ear to the streets, a lot of them was like, look, I'm vulnerable. You know, I really don't know what this is, but I don't really want to take the shot. But if it can maybe save my life while I'm doing whatever I'm doing with my life, I'm going to take it. Sometimes you might not agree with some things, but you have to also think, you always have to think about your community. Like, I didn't really necessarily agree with the shot, but some of the people in my community is like, T, the shot, I need it, but it's not offered where I'm at. So I brought it to them, because you always have to listen to your community. So we will be doing a lot of future ones. We are getting 100 to 50 to 200 doses, and we're planning on handing them out at the new Troy's Farmers Market, located by an old Purdy Shopper in Lansingburg. the old Price Chopper before you get to Waterford Bridge, come and definitely follow Equality for Troy, and just keep up on, you know, our efforts in the community. We're moving good, and we're moving in a nice strategic way to fit all members of the community.
Thank you.
You just heard the second part of Troy Prep Media Club Treasure Irvin's interview with Tresca Medina on her activist journey and her work with Equality for Troy. Part one of this interview is available on our website, mediasanctuary.org.
The Arts Center of the Capital Region just opened two new exhibitions around the idea of inviting the visitor into the artist's process. More Than a Sketchbook, The Diary of an Artist, and Cocoon, The Reveal, are viewable at the Downtown Troy Arts Center from April 30th to June 26th. HMM Sina Basilahicki spoke with our curator, Belinda Colon.
I want to make sure that people understand that there is a process when artists create work. Hi, my name is Belinda Colon. I'm the curator at the Arts Center of the Capital Region. We have two exhibitions opening up April 30th, running through June 25th of 2021. More Than a Sketchbook, The Diary of an Artist will be in our main gallery, and Cocoon, The Reveal will be in our Wallace and Foyer galleries. Right now I'm in the main gallery of the Arts Center of the Capital Region, and as you walk in, you see quite a bit of artwork around you. You also see books sitting on pedestals and placed in different areas within the gallery. It's a very open room. It's very lit and light, but it has quite a bit of different texture and color surrounding the space that you walk into.
In your hands, you have a Field Notes notebook. Could you tell the story about who is drawing in these notebooks and what did it become?
Yes, so here is one of the notebooks that we have. I like Field Book Notes because I feel like it's a really great size notebook. The quality is amazing, and it's easy to put in your bag. So a lot of artists will sit in a coffee shop or pretty much wherever they go, traveling, in a train, sitting at a restaurant, whatever they're doing, they just like to sketch. And so I've been surrounded by artists for a long time now, and everywhere I go, I see sketchbooks. And I'm very aware of the Brooklyn Sketchbook Project, and I thought it was a really great idea. And that program is where artists can buy a sketchbook, create work in the sketchbook, and then it is then displayed at the Brooklyn Museum in New York City. I really liked that idea, but I wanted to add to it. I wanted to show the work that was being inspired by what was in the sketchbooks. So I found this wonderful Field Notes sketchbook. It's very small. I reached out to our audience and our community artists, and I asked if anyone would be interested within a call for art to create work in a sketchbook. They didn't have to create the whole sketchbook or work in the whole sketchbook, but they had to create about 20 to 40% of the sketchbook, enough to really show the process they were creating. Or using to create one piece of work that we could visually display for people to see. And the reason being is I want to make sure that people understand that there is a process when artists create work. A lot of times we will be asked, why does that cost so much? What are these mediums? Why did they display it this way? Why blah, blah, blah? There are a lot of questions, and all the answers I don't have, but a lot of times if you were to look at an artist's sketchbook, you get an idea of what they were thinking and why they presented it in the way they did. Sometimes it's literally images, and sometimes it's actual descriptions of what they want to do. So I wanted to create this show to give the viewer a chance to go into the mind of the artist as much as the artist would give them, and be able to visualize and read about what it is that the artist was thinking when they created the work. So some of the notebooks have a lot of drawings and paintings in them. Some of them are collaged. Some of them are ripped apart and repurposed into another sketchbook. I did say to the artists to do whatever they wanted with the sketchbook, and then I would display it. One of them took it literally and tore it apart, which was fantastic. So when you come in to see the show, you'll see that some of the covers are developed and stylized between each artist, but the presentation should be pretty much the same. So when you see the sketchbook, you should be able to look up, see the name on the pedestal of the artist, look up on the wall, see the artwork, and really have an idea of what it's like to go into an artist's studio, see their work as it's presented from the artist, and then see the finalized piece on the wall.
So looking at the walls, there's some pieces in frames, others are fabric. There's some canvas pieces. What is the range of, oh, here's multimedia. Could you give a range of how a drawing from a sketchbook turns into an actual sculpture or art piece or the different ranges that we have here?
Well, I can tell you one, that depends on the artist, right? So not every artist in here has worked in every medium that they've presented, and this was a chance to work in some other mediums. I would definitely say that there is stained glass, there is oil painting, there's a lot of 2D and 3D art. We do have some video art in the back of the room as well that is a little bit of a storytelling documentary. We have sculptural 2D, 3D, quite a bit of different works. I picked the artists that I did because I wanted to try to make sure that we had a little bit of everything so that people could understand the process of all these artists. We also have 3D printed art, so that's something that people don't see very often. So it does range from newer technology to traditional work. One of the stipulations to being in the show is that you had to have some experience showing your artwork. Some of them really have only shown their art maybe 2 to 3 times, but because of the medium and the style that they had, I felt like they were a good fit to show a novice to a very experienced professional artist. And I would consider them all professional, but there are some with more experience than others. Now we're in the Wallace and Foyer Gallery. This is the Cocoon Show, which includes 4 artists who originated in our Cocoon Studio Show. So this is the Cocoon Reveal, which is the work that these artists had created starting last February in an exhibition that we started, or I should say a program that we started in our main gallery. We split up our main gallery into 5 different studio spaces, and we welcomed artists, many artists to apply. These 5 artists ended up getting the space, but they ended up setting up their own studios, 5 studio spaces, and started creating their works there. And the community was invited to come in at certain times of the day or during Troy Night Outs or during, what we wanted to have was small little workshops and demos with those artists. Again, focusing on like what we did with the sketchbook project, trying to share more of the process of how artists create with our community and our visitors so that there is more of an understanding between the visual representation of what the artist makes and what the artist's ideas are for those visual representations. So this is the reveal. There are 5 artists: Allison Bachrich, Lindsay Bystroff, John D'Souza, Emily Prosper, and Trent Stokes. This show really does represent the youthfulness of these 5 artists. 2 of them are St. Rose graduates. I believe 3 of them went to Hudson Valley, and then another went to another college in Florida. But when it comes down to it, there's this youthfulness, there's this colorful representation of their world and what's surrounding them. I know with John, Allison, Trent, and Emily's work, they're finalized pieces, but Lindsay is still working on these pieces, so these are still a work in progress. So it is a reveal to an extent, but she is still moving forward. So it's really wonderful that we have these 4 pieces that are final, and then we have this one set of works that actually is still a work in progress. I do believe that Trent also, who will be a little more visible in this region with some mural work, also is in process with some of the work as well. But that's for him to say. I believe he's going to be creating a statement that he hasn't shared with me yet that will share that information with the community. So when they come in and they read the statements from the artists, they'll be able to come in and read the statements and see where the work is developed from and what the artist has to say about what they created.
This show is about breaking down understanding the process of an artist. What have you found are some of the big misconceptions that you're trying to break down with this exhibition?
So some of the misconceptions about artists and how they create their work can be, why does something cost so much? Why doesn't everything look exactly like what a dog looks like? Or what, you know, why is it representational? Why is it abstract? Why is it created in this way or that way? What, you know, I can make a box with a square filled in it. Why is this person getting more attention for it than somebody else? And so with Cocoon and with most of the shows that I'll be presenting at the Arts Center, I want people to understand that there doesn't need to be a confusion in regards to why artists create what they create and how they create it. We can have a conversation. We can have a visual conversation with the work that's on the wall, and then at any moment, if you have a question, you can always reach out to the Arts Center and have those continued conversations. So these shows are visual representations of what I would like to invite the community to come and see, right? But I need the community to come in here to do that. And to break down these barriers about misunderstanding why something costs so much or what things are made of, you really need to have that interaction. So I invite people to come here, have this interaction with us here at the Art Center and with our artists, and continue to create a moment for them to learn about something maybe they weren't sure about in the past without feeling uncomfortable. I want people to feel comfortable. It's another part of this, is for people to come in and feel like this is a, you know, an art center. This is a community art center. So we really want the community and our region to come in and feel like they're part of something. And the artists that are here, I try to make feel like they have ownership of their work and their space when they're here, and then hopefully they will continue to create relationships where they want to come back and continue to develop more relationships with the community and with us.
You just heard from Belinda Cullen, curator at the Arts Center of the Capital Region's. These arts exhibitions will be running from April 30th to June 26th in downtown Troy. For more information, visit artscenteronline.org. Well, that concludes our show for tonight. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Kalen McPherson.
And I'm Justin Romero. Our engineer tonight is the lovely Sina Basilihickey. This program is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to the local stories of social and economical justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or join our weekly virtual Zoom meetings on Monday nights at 7:07 p.m.
Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news. You can find all of the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org, through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast, and on our Facebook page at WOOC 105.3 FM. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in. Stay safe and wear a mask.